Find out more at libertyinsurance.ie.
Mild tonight with rain at times. Lowest temperatures of 10 degrees.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now. Game on, weeknights from 6.
On 2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies for making us all hungry with all of those food craving stories. It's Thursday the 16th of May and this is Game On. Coming up today in Gaelic football, Conleth Gilligan gives his thoughts on Derry's momentum in Ulster and today's Tailteann Cup draw. And in hurling, Niall Moran on another twist in the Munster Championship.
I tell you, there's a Cork crowd getting ready here for an outpouring of emotion like you haven't seen maybe since the days of Italian 90 or something. This is going to be some victory for them.
Whether it keeps them alive or not in the Championship, only time will tell. But they've won here in Walsh Park. Cork doing exactly what they had to do.
In soccer, Alan Colley is all set for an exciting run-in in the Premier League as Man City are finally held.
Little steps to begin the run. Left-footed now. Fabianski saved!
Plus, we've new heroes of Irish boxing on the world stage. All that and much, much more. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Welcome along. Alan Colley is with me in studio. Alan, as you can probably hear, I have very little voice because I was at a lot of matches over the weekend and I have spent it just roaring and shouting at teams.
Are you one of these parents on the sideline, Marie, that actually just sits and watches the match, or lots of roaring and shouting?
Lots of encouragement.
Okay.
Yeah, I encourage them.
Yeah, that's probably a better phrase. Roaring and shouting make it seem as if you're just roaring and shouting anything, bawling.
Yeah, very positive.
Yeah, a bit like me.
Yeah. I'd say I'm actually the opposite to you.
No, I am very positive, helpful, but there is a little bit of a but because I'm helping coaching, so I'm trying to make them the best they can be.
It's very hard to get the balance right. And actually, it was quite interesting now that you mention it. I was out watching the DDSL finals at the AOL over the weekend. So there was loads of different teams and all different age groups and all different levels. But one game that I stumbled upon, because you could just walk around to all the different pitches and check out the games, was the Shamrock Rovers under-13s playing Joey's in the final of the DDSL, and I tweeted out a picture of their management team, which included, well, they were on the line anyway, Gavin Bazunu, Stephen MacPhail, Graham Barrett, Aaron Green and Shane Robinson, all current or former footballers, and the majority of them have players on the team as well. And then Robbie Keane was watching on from the sidelines. But between the two sidelines of Joey's and Shamrock Rovers, there wasn't a word. They were completely silent. They just let the players get on with it. There wasn't any criticism, negativity, positivity. There was nothing. I just thought it was quite interesting. It was obviously a decision that they'd made that they aren't going to be heard or to shout at the players. Now afterwards, when Shamrock Rovers won, they won by a goal. It was a real tight game. Goal came near the end. Shamrock Rovers management did have their team in and did a really long team talk. So I was just wondering if the fact that they hadn't been kind of maybe shouting out instructions during the game, did they just review everything at the end? And because you could see them remonstrating and pointing out things and, you know, the arm gestures and stuff like that. But it was just quite interesting to see it.
Yeah, it's obviously a debrief then after the match, Marie, where they go through things. And that sounds like maybe it was a conscious effort on their part not to be shouting and bawling instructions or whatever the case may be. Obviously, you were there.
There was a lot of eyeballs on them as well now.
Yeah, and I think, to be fair, like the names that you named, obviously all former players and players that have played at the very highest level. So one thing, and I don't mean this disrespectfully to coaches that didn't play at that kind of level, but you kind of find with lads who did play that they don't get involved in the roaring and shouting kind of thing like that. And there would be encouragement. I often find it's the opposite, maybe other lads that haven't maybe kind of experienced that, how could I phrase it, type of exposure to maybe a higher level that... And that's nothing against them, but it's almost as if they're trying to prove themselves to other people around them at times, I find. And I'm only doing it like the last kind of 18 months, 2 years. And I have to say 95% of my experiences with teams that we've played against have been absolutely brilliant. And they just let the lads play and the coaches just kind of get on with looking after their own little team. I'm still at the under 9 age group, so we referee the matches between ourselves. There's the odd decision, Marie, like that people disagree on. You have no problem with that. But generally, my experience of it has been very good. I know there's lots of stories and people will obviously might text in and all, and people who are listening to this and that might be involved or might not be involved, they might be just there as going along as parents supporting and watching. And there's loads of stories of parents getting involved when they shouldn't be as well. And sometimes it actually comes from them rather than the coaches as well, which can be hard to control. I'm not sure how you fix it, but certainly listening to that example that you used of Shamrock Rovers and the makeup, I suppose, of Shamrock Rovers at the minute, with all the lads dropping down from the senior team down, Shane Robinson has obviously assembled a group of coaches who were all previous players, former players, who kind of know what it's like to come through that path and that road. It sounds like the best approach to me, to be honest with you.
Yeah, can you imagine being a kid? Imagine being that goalkeeper and for Shamrock Rovers and having the guidance and the experience and the expertise of Gavin Bazunu. It's like you're being coached by your hero.
Absolutely, it's amazing. And to be fair to Gavin, I know he's very young, and I suppose the level of fame maybe that he's experienced so far in his early part of his career probably really hasn't hit him yet, because he seems like a very down-to-earth, humble kid. So he probably still feels like he's still very much a part of Shamrock Rovers. And I think he's been to 3 games since he's come home. He was up at the big game Friday night as well. But that's his club, that's his team, Marie, you know. So it's like anyone really that goes away. And I think that's something... Look, I don't know, I can't speak for players who come from other countries, but I think that's certainly a good Irish trait that we have, that generally, if it's not your family or your friends, they'll keep you fairly grounded and down to earth. And a lot of the lads that do go away, you often see them coming home and going back to, if it's a League of Ireland club or a schoolboy club or whoever it is maybe that they've come through. I think that's a good trait that we have been in, kind of passed on maybe from generations with parents and stuff. And I think it'll continue to go that way, because the one thing you always find, and even I know lads who have played, like you mentioned Robbie Keane, I know Robbie very well, Stephen McPhail, Kenny Cunningham, lads, you could drop loads of names here, and they're the best lads you'll ever meet, absolutely brilliant lads. And I think that's something, no matter what the level they've played at, they still come home and they're just kind of Robbie to their friends or to their family or whatever. I think that's a brilliant trait that the Irish people have.
Yeah, it was actually really that was really evident out there over the weekend as well. And even for the other kids that were there, like just watching, they were able to go over and get pictures, and they were so accessible. And it was just fantastic to have Ireland's record goal scorer there, and obviously the future then in Gavin Bazunu and all the other lads as well. It just gave everything a lift. But while I was there too, I witnessed P-Mount winning the under 14 title. They beat Rathcoole, and it was the very first girls team to win a DDSL trophy in 78 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was absolutely amazing. Again, I just stumbled upon it. It was a great day out. Then I saw the girls get their trophy and the speeches and highlighting that as well. And you could see the amount of girls out there playing. And just look, from a pure personal point of view, I just really, I enjoyed that a lot more than I enjoyed watching the boys play, because I just could sense that the growth is going to be phenomenal. That it feels still like it's at the start of something special, and the girls that are coming through and the sheer numbers of them, it was brilliant to see them, and the quality as well. Like you just know that in years to come that Irish girls and women's football is just going to get stronger and stronger. And just while I'm on the point of talking about the women's and girls sport, then on Saturday I was over at St Mary's Rugby Club, and they had a tournament for girls, and it was the first tournament that they had ever held, and there was hundreds of girls rugby teams from all around the country, all different ages, from 8 years of age well up to the mid-teens, and just to see them there playing the sport. And when you think, you know, only a few years ago there wouldn't have been those numbers, there wouldn't have been that pool, it was brilliant to see that as well. So it was just really enjoyable seeing the grassroots girls and boys.
To be fair, Marie, obviously you've been an advocate of the women's game and the women's sports across the board, not just soccer, but I think that's a clear indication. We've obviously covered the women's games, and you look at Vera Powell and the girls and where they're at, and Katie McCabe, and the progression that's been made, and even the domestic league here, the exposure it gets now with games on TV and all sorts. But I think that just the grassroots side of it, I think that's a clear indication. If you were saying the amount of girls that were there on a boys' final day, if you like, that would have been all boys years ago.
Yeah.
Whereas now you have boys and girls mixing on finals day. I think that's absolutely brilliant. And as I say, it's a clear indication of the speed and the rate of knots at how much the game is progressing for young girls. And I see it even at our local club in Portmarnock. The opportunities for young kids now, boys and girls, it's absolutely amazing.
That's what it is, Al. It's equality of opportunity, just to be able to get that chance. Even at Derry City and Shamrock Rovers on Friday night, the halftime game was a girls' game.
Yeah, brilliant. You never would have seen that before.
No, absolutely not. So while we're on the point of girls' sport and women's sport and the development of it, we're going to turn our attention to boxing and talk to Chris McNulty, a sports journalist. And it is the women's boxers that we are going to be talking about, because they are in action, or they were in action today at the World Boxing Championships, and we had 4 women out there. Chris, would you bring us up to speed on how they did today?
Yeah, so four Irish women in action today in Istanbul, Anne-Marie, and two wins for Ireland, Amy Broadhurst and Lisa O'Rourke, both guaranteeing themselves at least bronze medals. Superb wins for both of them today. Unfortunately, defeat earlier in the day for Charlie McNaughlin and Michaela Walsh. But what a day for Amy Broadhurst and Lisa O'Rourke, and what a day for Irish boxing. I mean, just to put that into some context, when Amy was the first of them to win today, she was the first, she's only the third Irish female to win a World Senior Gold Medal after Katie Taylor and Kelly Harrington. So, you know, a great day for Irish boxing in Istanbul overall.
Yeah, it really is. And just while we're on the topic of it, you know, you're mentioning the likes of Amy Broadhurst and Carly McNaughlin and Michaela Walsh and Lisa O'Rourke. And these are all names that we are familiar with now and have been over the last couple of years because of the Olympics and just the different exploits. But we're at a stage now, Chris, where women's boxing is taking its rightful place right up there beside the men. And these girls and women are going to be as much household names as their male counterparts.
Absolutely, Marie, and I suppose that all goes back. I mean, if you look at back in those days when Katie, in her early years, was slugging in, you know, small halls, even though there were big championships, you know, women's boxing wasn't in the limelight. And really, you know, I suppose on the back of Katie's superb success, you know, maybe a decade ago, women's boxing has really now come into the limelight. But that being said, I suppose these girls are also going out and performing and really achieving at the highest level. You know, I mean, look at Amy Broadhurst win today. She beat the Serbian Jelena Janisevic. And again, like, you know, to put that into perspective for listeners, she's the European lightweight professional champion. And she's got a pro record 4-1-1 and just won that European lightweight title back in March. You know, she drew with the opponent last September, who was 9-0 at the time. And Janisevic defeated her in March to win the European lightweight professional title. And Amy Broadhurst with a superb win today, beating her and finally getting onto that World Championship podium. And like, Lisa O'Rourke had only won gold at European under 22 level a few months ago back in March. And she, you know, Lisa's improvement and Lisa's rise through the ranks in recent months has been quite remarkable. So yeah, look, and even look at the likes of those girls, you know, that have lost out today. Like, we know all about Michaela Walsh and Charlie McNaughlin, other of those now firmly established in that Irish senior team. And you know, this Irish team now, really, I do believe will go from strength to strength.
So all good news on that front. What's to come now over the next few days, Chris?
Well, I suppose for Amy and Lisa, they face into semi-finals later in the week. Amy's up against an Indian, Parveen, who was a unanimous decision winner today. And I think, you know, looking at the records, that's certainly a winnable fight for Amy. Like, she can throw a really tough opponent today, an opponent with sort of real pedigree behind her. And I do believe, you know, Amy, as she always does when she goes to the ring, will fancy her chances. For Lisa, she's in against a Turk called Kaliskin, who beat a girl from Poland today called Darla Parada. And it was Parada who Lisa actually defeated to win the European gold, that under 22 back in March. So Lisa will be well aware of what she's up against as well. And, you know, hopefully both girls can upgrade, because not only, Marie, are these championships significant in terms of the colour of the medal, but also there's significant prize money available. You know, for bronze medals, the IBA have put up 21,500, or just over 21,500. That rises to 43,000 for the silver medalists. And the gold medalists, you know, the gold medals are worth €86,000. I mean, that's really, really significant prize money for amateur boxers.
Wow, that is absolutely fantastic. It's a big money, all right, for sure, and can make such a difference for everything when it comes to all their training and preparation and everything that they need from a support point of view. Let's move on now, Chris, as well, because there's been a little bit of a development for the IBA. The Minister for Sport, Jack Chambers, was speaking today on Clare Byrne, and he set a timeline for the IBA to adopt recommended guidelines for reform or face immediate and severe financial sanctions, which would threaten the future of the organisation. So things, if they weren't serious already, they've got even more serious.
Absolutely, Marie. And I suppose maybe, you know, to look at this in something of a positive, there's a timeline there now. There's a deadline now that the IBA simply must meet. I mean, Jack Chambers left absolutely no grey area today. Like, you know, funding will simply be withdrawn from the Irish Athletic Boxing Association if they don't simply clean up their act in terms of governance. I mean, I mentioned the funding to those, or the prize money available to those boxers. But, you know, the Sport Ireland hasn't withdrawn its funding, but it's paused on its funding to the IABA. Like, last year, the IABA received 770,000, like over three quarters of a million, went into Irish boxing, and that's to go across so many strands of the sport, you know, at grassroots level, from coaching, you know, to capital funding, to everything else, really. All of that now is in jeopardy, and you know, we talked about those boxers and how they've risen through the ranks within that sort of Irish high performance unit. But the potential withdrawal of that funding could be just a fatal blow for the other Irish boxers that are coming up through the ranks, and indeed for those who are in it, you know. And really, there's a message today to the IABA that, you know, really it owes its members and it owes every single person within Irish boxing. They just simply must comply, and they've got 3 months to do so. Or as Jack Chambers said, you know, I mean, he actually, there was a very telling comment today. He said, "We can't and will not be funding behaviour like this and governance dysfunction." You know, it really leaves at least no doubt as to the potential consequences.
He also gave his views on Bernard Dunn and the situation there and how he's been treated, and he wasn't happy about it, Chris.
No, he absolutely wasn't. I mean, he actually, his comment was frankly a disgrace in terms of how Bernard Dunn has been treated. And, you know, we spoke, Marie, last week about the SWAT analysis, that anonymous document that was circulated in the run-up to Tokyo, and which ultimately has led to Bernard Dunn resigning his position. Jack Chambers, as other people within Sport Ireland did last week, have said they would like Bernard Dunn to continue. Kelly Harrington had expressed a similar view, but I suppose again, you know, really it's now incumbent on the IABA to go along with these reforms. You know, there was a 68-page document last week, an independent report, where, you know, there was a lot of recommendations made and a lot of really significant recommendations for the IABA to follow. And you know, you look, it was quite clear today that government as well as Sport Ireland are rowing in behind Bernard Dunn, and I'm sure, you know, if it is any consolation, you know, Bernard, I'm sure, can be heartened that senior figures, not just as boxers, but people outside of the sport and people with real influence and people who really now are holding the purse strings of Irish boxing. I mean, if you take, you know, three quarters of a million of funding away from the IABA, then, you know, really, where does the sport go, or where can it go from there?
For sure. Chris McNulty, as always, thank you so much for bringing us up to date on all of that. We are going to take a very quick break, but before we do, I just want to mention Rashida Adelecki, who has broken another record. So last night she broke the Irish 400 metre record with a time of 50.70. She was running in the States, where she has been for quite some time. She's now the fastest Irish woman of all time at 60 metres, 200 metres, 300 metres and 400 metre distances. That is unbelievable. So she's been in Texas since January 2021, and it just shows when you do put a person into the right environment with the right coaching and the right setup, what they can achieve. And she is going to be an absolute superstar, and I can't wait to follow her career. Now time for a quick break.
RTE
2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. B vitamins equal big benefits. The new Green Farm added benefits range is packed with essential B vitamins. Available in store now.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now we are going to talk football. Alan Cawley is with me in studio. Alan, before we move on to what happened over the weekend and what could potentially happen tonight, let's have a chat about Jake Daniels. So just a little bit earlier, Jake Daniels is a Blackpool footballer, and he has came out as the UK's only openly gay active male professional footballer. So he gave an interview to Sky Sports today and said that he feels that now is the right time to do it. He feels he's ready to tell people his story, and remarkably, he's only 17 years of age. I think we should play a few clips for him just to show how brave he's been and just how articulate he is about his situation.
Why do you think there is this big taboo in male professional football about being gay?
I think it comes down with a lot of footballers want to be known as like masculinity, and I think being gay, a lot of people use it as being weak. So a lot of people would say, like, you're doing that because you're gay, and they're going to just say it's because you're weak, and it's just not the case. So a lot of people don't want to do that because in football they are masculine, and it's something that you can get picked on the field. So not a lot of people want to do it, but I think because no one's done it, there's just no one has the confidence to do it yet. So I want to be that role model to do it, to maybe push people to be able to come out.
It's remarkable, Alan, that he's the only one to be playing professional football that's out. When you think of how far we've came culturally and as a society, that the 17-year-old kid here is standing up, telling his story in the hope that he can help other people who might not be as comfortable with coming out. But given the amount of men who play football at a professional level, to think that they aren't comfortable in a situation where they can be themselves, it's just really sad.
It is really sad, and it's remarkable and such a historic moment this, Marie. And as you said, for a 17-year-old to be the one leading the way, it's absolutely incredible on his part. And the courage and bravery he has shown to come out, because it would have been so easy for him to just go with the norm and hide maybe in the background, Marie, and maybe wait for some more high-profile person to come out if that was the way it's going to play out. But for him to come out at 17, and even reading the story and speaking about the season and the year that he's had, and this was playing on his mind and weighing on his shoulders for such a long period of time, but he seems like a very confident young lad. He made his debut in May against Peterborough as well for Blackpool, and the fact that he's come out now at this time as well, at this moment in time, coming off the back of the season that he's had, he could have easily gone away and thought, I'll take the easy road and I've just made my debut, go off, do pre-season and come back and try and make a name for myself. But for him to come out now at 17 at this moment in time, I think it's absolutely unbelievable. And a historic moment, Marie, it really is, because up to now you would have expected, as you says, the world we live in nowadays, you would have absolutely expected, because there has to be gay footballers amongst teams in England and all over, and for somebody not to come out up to this point, I think it's been
it's a poor reflection on the game though, Alan, and the
dressing. Well, absolutely, and that's the main reason, and he spoke about it there, the fact that it's almost a sign of weakness, you know, that if you were to come out as gay in such a masculine kind of world as is, and I've been in dressing rooms and that's the world it is, Marie, you know. But I think the club should be applauded as well. He spoke about his teammates as well, for somebody so young, the support that he received from them as well and from the club. I think that's so important. But I think it just highlights the fact that because there is this taboo, and people are probably fearful. I can't speak obviously for anybody in that situation, and it must be very hard, but there's obviously that fear factor of coming out. But I think it just highlights now that come out, be brave, be strong, and if that's weight lifted off your shoulders. And also it highlights the fact that there is people in the game now with a broader view to these kind of stories and these cases, that you will be accepted, you'll be absolutely accepted in the footballing world. I think it's brilliant, and I think this lad has kicked it off now, and there's going to be more to come out afterwards.
Yeah, I think so as well. Justin Fashanu is obviously the last player that we'd all have known anyway that has come out, so that was back in the 90s. And then Adelaide United player Josh Cavallo is the only currently openly gay top flight male professional footballer in the world, obviously before Jake decided to come out, which is pretty phenomenal really. It'll be quite interesting, just given football culture as well and the amount of different abuse that is hurled at footballers for every sort of reason, if he is going to get homophobic abuse. Well, he was asked about it in the interview and he's quite a good answer.
Are you worried about homophobia moving forward from fans and on social media?
You know, I think it is an easy thing for people to target. You know, I'm kind of just learning that, you know, like, say I'm playing football on the field and they're shouting stuff at me, you know, you're paying to watch me play football and I'm living my life and I'm making money from it, so shout what you want, it's not going to make a difference, you know. So I feel like I can't stop people from saying that stuff, but I just need to learn that for it not to affect me.
God, he's such a mature guy. And what I loved about him, Alan, was that he said that he told his mom and his sister and there was a huge weight lifted off him, and then he went out and scored 4 goals the next day.
Yeah, and the reaction from his mum and sister was like, you're only telling us now kind of thing. We knew all along type thing. And they were obviously leaving that avenue for him to come out and be comfortable with that and telling them rather than them asking the questions. So he has the support of his family, the support of the club. And look, Marie, there'll always be idiots. There's idiots everywhere. They're all over the world. There's idiots in football stadiums. But as he said, he's thought long and hard about this, I would say. He's given it a lot of thought in coming out. And if people want to be those idiots, as I say, and that's a reflection on them if they want to hurl abuse at him. But he's getting on with things in the right way. Obviously, the career is going very well for himself at the moment. That's a massive weight lifted off his shoulders now. And he can just get on with playing football, and that's what he wants to do.
The women's game, it's not perfect. Women's sport is not, it's not where it needs to be. But one thing I'll definitely say about it is it's really inclusive, and it's a place where I don't think you even need to come out as gay. Nobody cares. You can be whoever you want to be and no one is going to bat an eyelid about it. Dressing rooms are totally welcome. I've yet to hear anybody that I know anyway on any pitch getting homophobic abuse. It just seems to be light years ahead of the
message. But do you know why I think that is, Marie? And it's interesting you bring that up, and you're well placed to obviously give a view on this. And why I think from the footballing side of things is they've normalised that. And that's the problem here with the football. And for gay people, I know I'm not speaking on their behalf at all, but I just think because it's not the norm, that's why they're so fearful about it. But believe me, I think, I've been in dressing rooms, Marie, but like tough dressing rooms, hard dressing rooms. But you know the bottom line about dressing rooms with lads? They're good lads at the back of it all. Mm. They'll accept you.
Yeah.
Or if you have a good manager, or you've good, and I know, look, I'm not comparing it to the women thing. You're right, we're a million miles behind in terms of the gap that needs to be closed on that front. But I think that's why the women's game is so good on that front, is because it's normalised.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. And look, hopefully for Jake that he is he doesn't get subjected to any abuse, and that
everyone will be watching his career now.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. Yeah, he'll become an icon. Look, good for him, and we wish him all the best for sure. And again, fair play, because it's definitely not an easy thing to do. Another thing that's not easy as well, Alan, is taking a penalty in an FA Cup final. They're tough.
They are tough, Marie. It was a great game, even though it was nil all. It was almost like the Carabao Cup final, where it was real intriguing, fascinating battle between two good teams. Both of them had different spells on top at different periods of the game. Both keepers played really well. But yeah, ultimately it comes down to the penalties. And this suggestion that penalties is a lottery, it's not. It's a battle of the minds, Marie, and psychologically and mentally, and who's the one that's going to stand up. And unfortunately for Mason Mount, he was the weak one. And do you know why I felt as well? I like Mason Mount. I actually think he's a great player. But you know something that's stuck out for me with the Chelsea penalty takers, and I was a little bit disappointed with it, and again, it might have been a sign of exactly, I suppose, the fact that Ziyech was the one that came sixth and Mount came seventh. Their first three penalty takers were defenders. To me, if you're a midfielder or a forward, you step up, bang, mm-hmm. away you go. You'd be grabbing the ball. You look at Liverpool's one, the opposite. And Azpilicueta was one. And when he was walking up, because Azpilicueta has been a great player for Chelsea, and he is a great player, but he's out an out-and-out defender. You wouldn't even class him as like the modern-day fullback that's good on the ball, or a centre-half that's a ball-playing centre-half. Azpilicueta is just defend, and a brilliant defender. When he stepped up, I was thinking, oh, now, thankfully for him, it didn't come down to that. But when it went on and it eventually comes to sudden death, Ziyech comes up sixth. He played really well when he came on. Surely he steps up as second ahead of Azpilicueta, and you get yourself in front on the leaderboard. And then Mount comes up. And Mount, to me, looks like a really confident lad, a confident footballer. He came seventh. Eventually, obviously, he missed it. But surely they should have been stepping up earlier than sixth and seventh.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear Jurgen Klopp saying they employed a company to work with them and to figure out what they need to do to be successful at them. He obviously has big plans for all of
them. I don't think they've lost the penalty shootout, have they, Liverpool?
Don't know.
Under Klopp, I think there was a stat going doing the rounds, but I don't think they have. But
Liverpool fans will text us in now.
Yeah.
Alan, let's park the FA Cup because there's so much on this weekend, and the Manchester City-West Ham game yesterday. When we were least expecting it, I have to say, for it to play out the way it did was just brilliant.
The football was brilliant over the weekend, Marie. And I say the cup final kicked it off Saturday. Well, Tala kicked it off Friday night, a great game. I'm sure we'll discuss that. But then Saturday, the cup final, and yesterday's football was absolutely brilliant. And just when we thought Man City have it all wrapped up, they just the spanner gets thrown into the works. And now it looks like we'll have a final day of real drama if Liverpool get the job done tomorrow against Southampton. But interestingly enough, Marie, I actually think when they got the FA Cup, and I often speak to you about this over the last few weeks about timing and when's a good time to play, depending on if a team's in a European final or whatever the case may be. And the way it was playing out on Saturday was Liverpool win the cup final, Man City will win Sunday, you would think. And then Southampton's game, I felt, especially when you think Van Dijk went off, Henderson went off, Salah went off injured, Robertson went off. They're out on their feet, Liverpool. They've played every game so far. It's phenomenal what they've done. I felt he would have just let that game go against Southampton and played the reserves and give some of them a rest. Now it's so important.
Yeah.
It's so important that he'll have to play some of the big boys again. And will that come against them when it comes down to the Champions League Saturday week? Because they're out on their feet at the moment and Real Madrid are just coasting into the Champions League final. So that could have a big bearing on the Champions League. But for right now, you have to live in the moment. They have to beat Southampton to make it interesting for us on Sunday.
Yeah, for sure. And we've already, well, my family have started sticking up the Steven Gerrard Liverpool flags on the windows of the house now. So they're all looking forward to that Aston Villa game. A lot of hope going into it. We will be chatting a lot more about the Premier League and that run-in with Mark Langdon and Stephen Kelly tomorrow. We're going to take a very quick break now, though.
RTE
2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's newest chicken and turkey range is full of B vitamins, which play a vital role in maintaining good health and well-being. Available in store now.
Game on.
Gaelic football.
Now, it was a really busy weekend of sport, but Gaelic football still managed to make its mark, and that was because of the Ulster semi-final between Derry and Monaghan, and Derry's very impressive win in that one to progress to the final against Donegal. I'm delighted to say that Conlath Gilligan is with me now to discuss all of the action. Conlath, it was such an impressive performance by them.
Yeah, it really was, and especially after the Tyrone game where, I suppose, as Derry supporters, we weren't really sure did Tyrone underperform. You know, did Derry get them on a bad day? But, you know, Derry showed, because they played exactly the same team, they had exactly the same game plan, and they were able to execute it perfectly to make light of Monaghan for long periods of the game.
And it's really interesting because for so long now they've just been viewed as the challengers, but now they've got this realistic chance of winning Ulster and potentially going on, and who knows, really?
Yeah, and the impressive part is that going into Tyrone, there was no expectation. It was, look, we'll have a cut at it and who knows. But there was expectations starting to build, and there was a wee bit of pressure on Derry this week. So from the point of view of the game, like, they handled it and they reacted to it and almost embraced it. And that's what was so impressive. And how they started, and again, you know, Kelleher has to get credit. He got his match-up, he got his tactics absolutely spot on, you know, two games in a row, and he's got a history of that in Ulster.
What I love about him as well is that he's not pretending that he's trying to build something great for the future. He said afterwards he wants to do it and he wants to do it now and be in the moment. And look, you can build for the future all you want, but what fans want is they want to win and they want to see their team going out there, putting in good performances and potentially going on to win titles. And he seems to be doing that as well.
Yeah, look, he's made no bones about an Ulster title from the outset, but that's what he really, really wanted. And look, and now he's put a Derry team that are capable of doing that. But Derry supporters have wanted something to get behind for a long time. Derry, for the first time in over a decade, sold their full allocation of tickets and money and sent tickets back. So the sports shops are sold out of Derry jerseys, which was unthinkable 3 years ago whenever they were languishing in the bottom ends of the National League. And it's been built slowly, and they've got progression. And going towards the end of this year, we thought maybe there was Roscommon in the Galway game. Maybe they're not ready, but they've stepped on and they've showed, you know, they're very much capable. And it was the level of performance and the fact that, you know, your Shane McGuigan's and your Gareth McInnes's were able to put in back-to-back huge performances. And that's what you need from teams that are going to be consistently at the top end.
When you think of Derry, and I guess when you think of Rory Gallagher, the automatic assumption is that we're going to see a team that is largely playing football around their defence. But with this Derry team, while they are very capable at the back, it's their scoring really that's capturing the attention of people. Like again yesterday, or over the weekend, scoring 3-12.
Yeah, and the thing about it is that Derry do play defensively, absolutely no doubt. And it's their ability to get, you know, 5, 6, 7 different scores game in and game out. You know, and Shane McGuigan obviously is the marquee forward. You know, he's been shooting the lights out all through the league. And yet again yesterday, he came out to the 40, and that probably threw Monaghan a wee bit in terms of their matchups. But he dictated the play. He got a couple from play, got a mark. And whenever the game was in the melting pot, it was him that stood up and just got the wee scores to keep Monaghan out of range.
So what about Monaghan then? They were the favourites going into it. Banty had huge expectation for this team as well, and to fall short, really disappointing for them, just given the players that they have and the performances that we've seen from them over the last few months.
Yeah, it will be, because, you know, they finished the league with such momentum, you know, beating Dublin, and that looked like it was going to be a big signature game that would set them up for the season ahead. And, you know, obviously they've got, you know, a backroom team that would rival anything in Ireland. And, you know, looking at the team, they were so well conditioned, and it was just the performances didn't happen. You know, the Jack McCarns didn't have the game that they were expecting from him. You know, McManus chipped in from freeze but didn't really get going from play. And ultimately, look, there'll been a lot of criticism, probably unfairly, about the matchups. You know, because you do everything in the best faith and sometimes just players don't perform. But, you know, in terms of Desi Ward, Mark and McGuigan, it just didn't work. You know, bringing in Shane Carey to Mark Gareth McInnes, it just didn't work. And as well, signposted, you know, there was no shocks from Derry. Monaghan knew exactly what we were going to do, but whether it was a tactical thing or whether it was a player performance thing, they just couldn't get to grips with the game in the first 30 minutes. And they were so wasteful. Like, the 36 shots in the whole game, you know, that should have been enough to get them over the line, but they were very wasteful, and it was Derry's ability. They got two goal chances, they scored two goals, and ultimately that was the difference. That gave Derry the platform, you know, to hold on. And whenever Monaghan did come strong, and they did, to be fair to Monaghan, they did put up a real good fist of it, and they got downed into 3 points, but Derry were able just to hold them off. And once they got the goal the second time, it just looked like there was no way back for Monaghan from there.
So are Derry good enough now to go on and beat Donegal and win the Ulster title, do you reckon?
Yeah, I'm afraid to say yes, because we're there to dream again in Derry. But look, I think given what happened last year in the Championship and how close an unfancied Derry team was to turn over Donegal, Derry have improved. And yes, they're good enough to beat Donegal. But again, it's a third Division 1 team for a Division 2 team in the Championship. And it just shows just how difficult the Ulster Championship is to win. But Derry have definitely put themselves in a position, and they're good enough. I suppose the caveat being that they did look like they picked up an injury to Niall Loughlin yesterday, and, you know, which looked serious enough. Obviously, Conor Doherty went off, looked more precautionary, and, you know, they're two men that have been in the form of their life. So if Derry can get them back fit, and they'll need a fit pick from a fit squad, you know, there's absolutely no reason why Derry wouldn't be good enough to win an Ulster Championship for the first in a long time.
We also know who's going to be contesting the Leinster final as well. Dublin defeated Meath quite comprehensively yesterday, and then Kildare beat Westmeath. Good performance from Kildare as well. Let's just start with Dublin, because there's so much interest in them, even though we didn't get to see them on the TV yesterday. They weren't shown, but they definitely, from the highlights, looked much more like the team, the Dublin team that we know, as opposed to the one that we've seen maybe when they were struggling in Division 1.
Yeah, I think anybody that had written Dublin off because of their league is probably looking at it now and feeling very, very silly, because Conor Callaghan's come back, you know, Costello's come into a bit of form, and James McCarthy's there. They suddenly look like a different unit. You know, but the thing from yesterday, when you look at where Monaghan went wrong, at one point in the first half, that a 33% scored a shot accuracy rate. Dublin scored 17 points from their first 18 shots. Like, that's off the scale, you know, and it doesn't matter who you're playing and what division they're in. To have that level of consistency, that's going to be hard to beat later on down the line. But Meath just never really get up to the pace of the game by the looks of it. And obviously the couple of silly sendings off will probably hurt Meath when they're looking at qualifiers. But look, Dublin are coming back really strong. And with Kildare on the other end, who are probably the pretenders to that crown, and through the league, and a really good league, you know, the likes of Jimmy Hyland and players like that, you know, Derek Sherwin had a big game yesterday, Ben McCormick. They have the stuff to trouble Dublin, but the fact that it's in Croke Park and Dublin are so comfortable there, they're so used to winning there, it's going to be very hard to see anything other than Dublin winning Leinster again.
The one thing about Kildare, though, is that they're starting to reflect their management a little bit more every game that we see them, and they are a lot steelier than they have been in the past, and you can see that they really are playing for that Kildare jersey. They didn't probably perform to their optimum, and you could see Glenn Ryan afterwards, he was quite disappointed with the performance. He was asked straight afterwards, would the performance be sufficient to win a Leinster final? He said he doubts it, but they're going to have plenty to work on, and they will know from looking at Dublin as well that there are some chinks in their armour.
Well, there are, and look, if you're going to go into a Leinster final, you want to go in under the radar and without shooting the lights out. So, and it gives Glenn Ryan and Anthony Rainbow and Doyle all the ammunition they have to get them back into camp and really go hard at them. But a lot will depend, you know, for Kildare to win this game, Daniel Flynn has to have the game of his life. You know, Paddy Woodgate, Paul Cribben, Ben McCormick, these players all have to play out of their skins, and it's just going to be very hard to see Dublin not performing. Like, defensively, they looked good yesterday. They weren't really tested, but Kildare have an opportunity. But again, it's a window that they need to take. The league was good, but they have to build on that. And when you look at where Meath were at, you know, the gap was just so huge, and you just wonder, you know, our Dublin starting to go up through the gears just at the right time.
Yeah, he did kind of get that sense all right. There was a calmness and a composure about them that we hadn't seen for quite a while, and they just seemed to know what they were about and what they were trying to do. So that Leinster final should be interesting. Anyway, we're also going to have a Munster final with Limerick taking on Kerry after Limerick performed really well to defeat Tipperary over the weekend as well. And disappointment for Tipperary, but Limerick do deserve an awful lot of credit for everything that they've achieved over the last few months.
Yeah, look, I was actually at that game, and I suppose I was expecting, because the two teams weren't a million miles away in terms of divisions, you know, Limerick, yeah, they'd done really well to get promotion as the Tipperary and probably the tradition and the fact that they'd won the Munster title in 2020. I suppose, look, I was expecting it to be a better game. It didn't really ignite. Obviously, Tipperary were down a lot of men from that team. You know, really, there was only the likes of Luke Boland and Connor Sweeney and, you know, Colm O'Shaughnessy, who sort of survived from the team that won it. But credit to Limerick, they'd done everything they needed to do. Like, they're playing for Billy Lee, you can see that. They had all the big performances. And again, the fact that, you know, the likes of Josh Ryan was been talked about coming into the game, and Connor Sweeney was going to be a shootout, it didn't really ignite that way. It was the likes of Killian Fahey coming from midfield. You know, I thought Cian Sheehan, you know, while he didn't score from wing half-back, was a driving force. Ian Corbett, you know, a really strong half-back line where Paul Maher sat in. And Limerick deserve a lot of credit. And again, it was the likes of, they were able to bring on Robbie Burke. You know, he scored 1-2 again the first day out, and he got another 3 points yesterday. And I suppose somebody beside me said, like, what's he going to have to do to start? But I would imagine he's played himself into that super sub position where as soon as he comes on, you just know he's got danger written all over him.
Is that a position that anyone ever wants?
Nobody wants it, but like most teams now, you know, when you look at the successful teams last year, when you look at what Tyrone had, you know, Cathal McShane coming off the bench, Dara Canavan, and this year they haven't had that, and they just don't look as dangerous. And Dublin were probably the first team to start it where you finish with a stronger team than you started with, and you know, you always have to leave a player like that you're going to get a reaction out of.
So we have the pairings now for the Tailteann Cup. Are you interested more than you were before now that we know who's going to be playing who?
Yeah, look, it does. The fact that, you know, I sort of turned on the radio this morning so I could get hearing the draw, and, you know, it does create that wee bit of excitement. It's not what people would have hoped it would have been. I think the North-South divide doesn't please many people, and I can understand the reasons for it. You know, the fact that, you know, it maybe saves money, you might get novel provincial pairings that might ignite the consciousness of supporters. But I think from a player's perspective, from county's perspective, I think they like the novel pairings where you maybe get a Cavan going to play Westmeath or Tip. You know, the fact now you've just got, you know, like a mini Ulster championship with, you know, with, I suppose, Longford and Leitrim and Sligo thrown in there along with London. But like, there are some good games there. Like, you know, you look at Cavan and Down, and all of a sudden, you know, Cavan were Ulster champions in 2020 as well in this competition. Down have the tradition. You know, that's going to be the tail around for me. But I think it will be the later stages that it will get a wee bit more exciting whenever it sorts out. But it's how it goes from here. Will it get the coverage? You know, will players buy into it? There's still an expectation maybe that, you know, players maybe aren't as excited. But like, I know playing myself, whenever you went out of your provincial championship, the first round qualifiers, even for Sam Maguire, were very hard to get up for. Yeah. And then once you got a win there and you got on a roll, it felt like you were back in the championship. And I don't think this will be any different. You know, I think all the teams that are in the Tailteann Cup, probably except Cavan maybe, are looking at it as a massive opportunity. Cavan probably, we're all going to be favourites for that. But it's a huge opportunity for your, you know, on an Ulster perspective, you know, for Mana and Antrim and teams like that to get a run at it. And I think that'll bring players on where they could get another two or three games as opposed to just one game in a qualifier and you're gone.
Yeah, that's the thing really. Like, the players want games, and if they can get in a run on in it, great. But it is quite difficult when, you know, if you lose, you're gone as well, you know. So it's, I think it probably has a little bit of a way to go, but it'll definitely be interesting to see how it plays out.
And even within that, you know, you look at the manager cycle, you know, the cyclical thing of managers coming and going every 2 years. You know, there's a lot of managers within these teams that have had poor years, and they're maybe in their second year, and they went out of the provincial championship early, and all of a sudden there's a clamour for change. They can get a run. And the one thing that teams need is the fluidity of management. If you look at any of the top managements for top counties, they've all been there 3, 4, 5 years. But you need something to pin your hat on. And for one of these managers, this is a chance of a competition. You know, semi-finals and finals in Croke Park. And that's where players want to be. And I think once we get through the sorting out phase. Obviously, there's a preliminary round to happen in the South. But once we get into that, you know, there'll be some good games coming down the line. And I think players will buy into it. And it's whether it can get the coverage to probably make it really, really good. That'll determine whether players into the future will think it's a good idea or not.
Yeah, that's for sure. Because when the games are coming around, you do have the Champions Cup final and you have the Champions League final, and we're coming to the end of the Premier League as well, and then you'll have the end of the URC. So there is a lot happening, but no doubt we will be talking about it at some stage. Conor Gilligan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Marie.
RTE 2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. Green Farm's new added benefits range is enriched with all your B vitamins, which are essential for your health and well-being. Available in store now.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. It's time to turn our attention to hurling. Alan Cawley is still with me in studio and Niall Moran joins us on the line. Niall, we don't have a huge amount of time, but we do have some unbelievable games to get into, and I wasn't even sure where to start, but just given the fact that you're from Limerick and I'm from Clare, probably the best place, really. Did you enjoy the weekend?
Ennis was happy, Marie, because like old times there. I think Alan, he'd be well familiar with the La Bombonera, the Matchbox, where Buenos Aires play over in Argentina, and it had that kind of sense to crowd her up on the pitch.
Brilliant.
They were up on each other, and they're in high spirits beforehand in the pubs, and they're even better spirits after. So it was an amazing occasion. It kind of really got a sense of old Munster Championship, and I really think it was kind of what made it for both teams is that both of them obviously qualified to Munster final after it. So 3 weeks' time, we can't wait.
There was a football field with some of the antics on the pitch as well, Niall.
I know.
Fellas feeing and injuries and all sorts of carry on.
I know. Look, all those things, there's probably a bit of gamesmanship there, and I know last week spoken about the yellow cards, etc. And look, it didn't dampen what was an amazing game. I suppose, like, when you're like, we're going to talk more about the likes of what Tony Kelly did, 16 points in 45 minutes of hurling. Dermot Burns, like, how many guys have got 9 points in play, wing back? There was some outstanding. It was just an unbelievable contest, unbelievable. Both teams gave of their all, and I suppose it spoke volumes for the identity of their managers, in the sense that, like, that's what you would have expected out of Brian Lohan and John when he was hurling for Limerick. And both teams just really went at it hammer and tongs. And there's a countdown to the Munster final, because I actually think both teams, obviously Limerick will have a lot of personnel to return, but I even think Clare, I think they have a lot more to get out of, like Shane O'Donnell, Peter Duggan there, and they'll be disappointed with their own personal contributions, and they'll bring a lot more to the table the next day too.
Yeah, and even from a confidence point of view, look, I'm sure that they knew themselves that they could go toe-to-toe with Limerick, but as you said, Niall, when you saw it in that environment, in a packed Cusick Park with the sun shining, it did feel like it was a throwback to those special days where, you know, Limerick weren't that dominant team, where you were going into a game and you didn't know who was going to win.
Jeez, Marie, when they weren't dominant, they weren't so special if you were from Limerick. he's you know, on the rivalry, he's coming back into it. But yeah, look, it was old Munster Championship. Like, I suppose there's nothing like a full stadium. And I suppose also, like, the sense there yesterday was there was a bit of sun was shining. It just felt like Munster Championship, even going through it, whereas probably in previous weeks you were still wearing a woolly hat. And so the pubs in Tipperary, they're not as friendly as what they are inside in Kieran, in Ennis and that. So, it was a brilliant occasion. And I suppose then, like yesterday, really kind of copper fastened the reason behind this round robin. And you see the result below Waterford, that Cork all of a sudden are back into the Championship. And I felt for Liam Cahill this morning getting up out of bed. He felt like he went Stewie out of the hangover. He says, what's just after happening here? Piece together the bad. So and look, they're still not gone either, but it's hard to see beyond Cork maybe the next day. Like, John, you'd imagine that they should have enough for Tipperary, but then you're back to old rivalries and Tipperary now back in it. So it's a really interesting Munster Championship, and obviously a really interesting Leinster Championship coming next weekend as well.
Yeah, for sure. But just on Waterford there, and you mentioned Liam Cahill, what is it like, why have the wheels came off in such dramatic fashion?
I suppose it kind of comes with maybe, I suppose, that sense of, like, again, in Waterford, we all spoke about them as potential All-Ireland champions, and they still are. If they can survive past next again, they still are. But however, it's a little bit like when you have that level of expectation on a young team, sometimes you can, if you're climbing the ladder, and sometimes you miss your step. And I think an element of that happened with Cork. Previous to that, especially against Clare, so they felt they were going to be better than Clare, and then they missed their step, and all of a sudden they were nearly out of the Championship. And I think for Waterford yesterday, they felt, look, home crowd, Cork are probably on the rack here. Look, we'll see him off eventually. And
Cork just clung into the game, just stuck in the game. I remember I just left home there and it was 6-3 and I was watching television. I remember saying, 6-3 to Waterford, I remember saying, Cork are going to win this game. They just fought, they kicked, they hit, they fought in the line, they fought in the pitch. Like Damien Callahan, the first few minutes, hit a couple of clangers, like hit a couple of lads like that, like Darragh Fitzgibbon, Mark Coleman. I personally was very critical of them here a couple of weeks ago because this is their team. They stood up, and then obviously we knew Shamey Harnedy just turning back the years there again. Like when he's in that kind of form, he's one of the best forwards in the country. And Waterford just weren't able to live with it. And so if you're not fully tuned in, it's very hard mid game to try and turn things around. And they just find themselves now wondering where is it all just gone wrong.
I'd say Wexford are probably wondering the same as well, but it's Westmeath really that deserve their moment in the sun. They were to score 215 against that Wexford team was phenomenal.
Yeah, so and look, obviously you said 215 wouldn't be enough to it. And look, again, it's just credit to Westmeath because it's like every time when you're trying to rise it up, like it's so hard to get those wins. And we saw last year with Antrim, like they were getting all these moral victories, but ultimately you need to get a result out of it. And for Westmeath, that was a major result. And even for a veteran like Derek McNicholas, who's around a long time, try and get the winner at the end, I'm sure it was special for him because he's seen a lot of bad days. But ultimately for Westmeath, the unfortunate thing is Laois are waiting in the high grass from next Saturday, and Laois have taken some trimmings over the last few weeks, but all they have to do is produce one performance and it could all soon be forgotten if Westmeath are turned over next Saturday, and they'll have it all to do again to beat Laois, who will come with that one big performance that every team has in the championship.